Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 119, Buddha Nature Revealed as Loving Activism.
Whenever you are.
Okay. Greetings. Happy 19th of May, 2017, Tibetan Royal Year 2144, Year of the Fire Bird in the Kalachakra time machine system, which I call the Year of the Phoenix, rising from ashes, not just Year of the Fire Rooster. But a fiery rooster is pretty lively too, actually. I don't need to be so whatever. So today I am inspired. I'm in a very happy mood because a wonderful book just came back from the printer, done by a former student of mine and now a colleague, Bo Jiang, whose nickname is Marty. And I learned a lot. I edited heavily his work in English because he really translates best into Chinese. He's the foremost, I would say, of this generation, translator from Tibetan and Sanskrit into Chinese. More or less, I think, foremost. And he did a job with a beautiful book of Maitreya, the future Buddha, at least we Mahayana Buddhists believe, not some invisible human person who took the name of the Bodhisattva Maitreya, who waits in the Tushita heaven in order to come to Earth maybe a few thousands of years from now, but is present on Earth in the form of dogs, in the form which to help people feel a sense of loyalty and trust and to develop the ability to pet someone else, and also in the form of various individuals. And he also channels teachings through various people. In ancient time, he channeled through someone called Asanga, Arya Asanga, who was a great, great philosopher, writer, what we call a second Buddha, a fully enlightened being in the fourth century of the Common Era. And he wrote a work, Maitreya did, called the Uttara Tantra, the Sublime Continuum, as it has been called. And then he wrote, Asanga wrote a commentary on it. And then Gyaltsab Jay, who was the foremost disciple of Lama Tsongkhapa, who lived in the early 15th century, who did his main work in teaching in the early 15th century, was, I would say, the Renaissance, the archetypal Renaissance man of the planet. You know, if Shakyamuni Buddha's morphic or limbic resonance or morphic resonance created the axial age on the planet or was contributed to the axial age on the planet, let's say, time of the pre-Socratics, time of the Hebrew prophets in Babylon, and the collectors of the Talmud and the Jewish Bible, and time of Zoroaster in Iran, time of Confucius and Lao Tzu in China, so-called Axial Age. If that was the case, then Lama Tsongkhapa, not far away, but over the passes in the high-altitude Tibet, was the anchor of a limbic resonance, you could say, who gave birth to the many great figures of the Renaissance, early 15th century, late 14th, early 15th century, and things that we don't know as a Renaissance, but actually happened in Ming Dynasty China, happened in Tokugawa era Muromachi and Tokugawa era Japan, Muromachi, Tokugawa era in Japan, and in many other cultures that we don't really have a record of. But that was a really, really big time. It was the time when the first Chinese ships reached America, which we no longer know about. And eventually the Europeans followed along with their brutal galleons, small boats compared to the Chinese boats, by Columbus and company, as preceded by Scandinavians and by Chinese, actually, in their giant 300-meter-long, huge sailboat galleys with their invention of the compass and the whole thing. So if you give a limbic resonance or morphogenetic resonance history of the planet, then these things are really important. So anyway, Gyaltsep Jay was the foremost disciple of Tsongkhapa's, and Tsongkhapa in his lifetime, his post-enlightenment lifetime of 21 years, 1398 to 1419, didn't have time to personally write a super commentary on the unexcelled tantra, the sublime continuum, the uttermost tantra, meaning continuum, and its commentary by Asanga. But his ideas were shared by his disciple, Gyaltsep, who then did write this super commentary. And Bojang translated into two different Chinese versions, as well as an English version. But by the time he was finalizing the English version, he'd gotten a little rusty with his English. So unfortunately, I had to help him with my own poor editing. But I was so thrilled to do it because I learned a great deal about this new way of understanding the sublime continuum and Maitreya's teaching, which is not what the usual one is. It's something really more special and more wonderful, I think. So I owe my student this debt of gratitude for bringing this really strongly to my attention. Of course, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, all the great Tibetan scholars, they know this perfectly well. It was a little bit news to me, who had the more older-fashioned idea about a particular thing known as the Buddha nature teaching. Now, I'm saying, although in my podcast, I like to keep people aware of a kind of Dharma activism, which is the thing that I feel we are called upon to do. Being aware of Dharma, having benefited from Dharma, meaning Dharma meaning reality and the teaching that opens our minds to reality, not necessarily meaning some sort of religious doctrine, but meaning the actual reality itself, Dharma means, and in its highest meaning, and Dharma also means the teaching given by enlightened beings, starting with Buddhas, that opened the door for people with different aptitudes, different languages, different understandings, different planets, actually, but mostly human beings, best of all human beings, opens their door to understanding their own reality, which when you really fully do understand your own reality and the reality you have to understand as well, the reality of the world around you at the same time and the reality of other beings at the same time. And when you do that, you become truly released, liberated, happy, compassionate, kind, loving. And, you know, death is not a problem for you. Your life is boundless. You can sail through death just like someone would sail through sleeping and waking. You shed one body and pick up another, better one, just like someone just sloughs off an old suit of clothes and puts on a nice, beautiful new one, like invested with their newest creativity. And this is how you live. It isn't that death has no more claim over you because you already annihilated yourself, as people wrongly understand Buddhism sometimes, and they think nirvana is just a kind of annihilation, self-annihilation. But that's not correct. That is really not correct. So to bring it in the context of this activism, why do we have more energy ultimately, or would we have more energy in our activism and more success if the more we understand the nature of reality? And this gives us more energy in our activism, and it enables us to prevail over ignorance, misknowing, self-hatred, other hatred, self-violence, other violence, cruelty to others, cruelty to the self. It enables our love and our happiness and our healingness and our compassion to overwhelm that in the long run, as is happening on this planet. Because in the last centuries, the more people have become more aware of what's around them, more males have become more kind and aware of the higher understanding of their environmental awareness, you could call it, of females, and learning from them and learning to lay aside their weapons and lay aside their violence and lay aside their insecurities than have ever happened in history before on this planet, in this cycle of history, let's say, before on this planet. And in a way, this has seemed to have had no impact on the planet because people who become like that become vulnerable, they become gentle. And so as the balance shifted, the demographic balance shifts, then they, you know, until it shifts to where their majority is completely irresistible, they tend to be led by the violent, frustrated ones who are more activists, actually, and more arrogant and more violent and more intent upon controlling others because they can't control themselves. And then they become more violent about it because when they do control others, they still are not satisfied or happy. And they think maybe by the others are getting in their way, so they become very destructive and murderous about them, actually. These leaders do, with their wars and their pollutions and the bad food they create and the polluted elements of earth, water, temperature, climate, and wind and air. Even every space they pollute, you know. So there is an activist element to this, and that is to ensure you all that you're the winner. Those of you who want to be aware of reality, who want to be realistic, which Dharma teaching, Dharma practice enables you to be most effectively about your own psyche, about the world around you. Those of you who want to, you are, but once you start in that direction, even the tiniest bit, you will be the winner. It doesn't mean you might win a normal sort of dominance era conflict. You might even let another person win that conflict. But because you can't lose once you're the winner. And even, you know, even they harm you, you are in a way ultimately inviolable. But relatively, you could be violated. And then those other nervous ones, you know, they think somehow they might get to you by doing something to you and you might suffer. But we're right in the end of that kind of history, actually. You know, Francis Fukuyama proclaimed the end of history with the fall of the Soviet Union because he was only thinking about capitalism, and of course he made a grave mistake. But there is an end of this history, the violence history, which can be communist or capitalist or whatever, where, as the human beings become more aware of their limbic resonance, their... And everyone who is aware of the great work of the Wachowski sisters should be aware of this. They are predicting, they are prophesying in the Cloud Atlas and later works like Sensate. They are prophesying this: the win, the victory of gentleness, the victory of love, the victory of kindness, which the Dalai Lama, of course, is the archangel of teaching as an ordinary human form. But still relatively ordinary human form. He is the archetype of teaching this. So therefore, what is it that encourages us is when we know what is the reality. And the reality is that you should never be discouraged. You should never be frustrated, unhappy, because you are the winner. You have won from the primordial, from the beginning. From the beginning less, however, in Buddhism. So the primal, let's call it. You primally win, no matter what. So just that gives you the buoyancy, the resiliency, and the joy, and the happiness that enable you to overcome seeming loss, and seeming pain, and seeming suffering, and seeming oppression, and so forth. That's what gives you the power to do it. So that's what I want to share with you today. And I'm going to share it with you in the form of reading you. I was so thrilled to receive this book, I have to confess. Because, you know, as the editor of the book in English, my Chinese is inadequate to edit it in Chinese, and he doesn't need me to anyway. Bo Jiang, who is such a brilliant young man, younger man than me, my former student, but I had to edit for him in English because his English got rusty and so on. And he's mainly focusing on enriching Chinese civilization by bringing, not only helping revive their deep Buddhist knowledge and faith and Buddhist joy and beauty back to the sort of dreadfully revolutionized and oppressed China of the last centuries, the decadent century of the Manchu Empire, 19th, and then the horrible century of imperialist Westerners Manchus were imperialists too, actually, but still they're coming into their own anyway now. But to do so, they got very rigid, just like original unity of China by Qin Dynasty was a very rigid, oppressive time to reconstruct sort of a structure out of chaos. And then that led to the flowering of the Han Dynasty, who then immediately adopted Buddhism toward its high points, because Buddhism is reality science, not because they were finding their own religions inadequate. It's not like they adopted Buddhism as a religious conversion necessarily. They adopted it as knowledge of reality, actually, knowing reality. Anyway, in this text, in the English version, I wrote a preface, and I couldn't even believe that I wrote it when I reread it. I thought someone else must have written it because I really liked it. I usually am very critical of whatever I write, and I feel myself groaning when I'm doing it. And this time, it was like someone else did it. It was inspired, I think, by what I discovered. And what, in a nutshell, what this is, is from a Buddha's point of view, when you become a Buddha, you yourself, you identify your own body-mind complex as what is called Dharmakaya, or a body of reality. So you identify your own body-mind as all of reality. But this all of reality is not just some inert bunch of rocks and things and trees and weird biological entities running around in the rocks and trees. It is this reality includes all the other sentient beings and their sentiency and their suffering, actually, which you are attuned to through your compassion. In order to reach that level of vast expansion, you have to open your sensitivity to the deepest nature of all matter and energy, and the deepest energy of all life and living beings, and you discover that the deepest energy that is the essence of life is bliss. And you don't discover that as something outside of you, you discover that you are that bliss. But it also is everybody else. You discover they are also bliss, all of them. Even those in hell are bliss, actually. But they create hell out of ignorance of what their true nature is by separating themselves from others, by harming them, by being violent and being afraid of them and defending themselves inside iron walls of separation and violent red heat that will burn away anybody who comes close to them, but which and then ends up burning them or freezing them or whatever it is, all the different kinds of most horrendous possible sensory states and mental states than you can possibly imagine, but people have imagined them all, however. But you can create that because you have infinite energy because you're made of bliss. But the one who knows that is called a Buddha, an enlightened or awakened being. They're awakened to their own reality and everyone else's reality. So their awakenedness to the bliss reality of every being gives them the power and energy to tirelessly interact with these beings who, because of not knowing their own true nature, are suffering. They're fighting off the rest of reality. They're closing themselves off to their own constitutional deep inner energy, their deep inner bliss energy, and they're fighting with everybody. And if a big flood of energy comes toward them, they fight it off, thinking it's going to drown them or make them ill or overwhelm them or they lose control or whatever it is. And so you are seeing them with a dual vision, non-dually, which is to say you are completely aware of their bliss nature, which gives you, through your wisdom, which gives you the power and ability to do something about their non-bliss nature, which is on the level of their confusion and ignorance and used to be on the level of your confusion and ignorance and your misknowing, your failure to know the reality. But now you're free of that failure to know, so you're just adding the knowledge, or you're restoring, or you're returning to, or you're rediscovering the knowledge of your own reality that has always been your reality, this bliss. Super bliss. And this gives you the strength to incorporate continued attunement to the unreality of the world created by the ignorance of the beings who do not know their own reality. I think that's pretty clear. You might have to listen to that several times. But it's pretty clear, although that clarity is based on a preliminary admission that no bunch of words can fully capture the inconceivability of the blissful, miraculous reality in which we live. However, what the Buddha nature theory is teaching, or the Buddha nature teaching is telling us, but from the future Buddha, who wants us to have the strength to continue to shape the world positively so he will come until he comes, and the noble Asanga, who worked with him on that and who elaborated, who was a medium for him and then elaborated his teaching most brilliantly and most healingly, and then Gyaltsap Rinpoche in the 15th century, who brought it up to date to us in the terms of the sciences and the philosophies of his time, and which now we are expanding to incorporate the people who are the beneficiaries of the worldwide renaissance of this same time, 15th century. Okay? So the point is, the Buddha nature thing means that from Buddha's point of view, we already have a Buddha nature, which means a super bliss, free, non-suffering, nirvanic nature. That is what we're made of. It's sometimes called clear light of the void. Our personal continua is made of that and has always been made of that. And at the same time, so that's what we really, because so Buddha is aware of our reality, actually. Now, what we are aware of, and we tend to more identify with, is our unreality of being a separate being who is not the same as the Buddha. But the point is, our worldview and our perception is based on misknowing, knowing wrongly, not knowing, and the Buddha's is based on knowing, accurate knowing, precise knowing, scientific knowing, total intuitive knowing by being. So, irrefutably knowing. Not knowing at arm's length through a concept, through some idea or theory or even mathematical or what any kind of whatever it is. So that's, now then, however, so then the presence of the Buddha's heart in our hearts, and actually in every cell of every part of our body, not just the heart, brains, neurons, subatomic particles, and in the area of super subtle energy where there are no particles, you know, beyond the wave particle paradox, where everything is inconceivable, where you have spooky action at a distance, but it becomes, the mind also goes there and it becomes conscious spooky action at a distance, or conscious spiritual action at a distance, you could say. And so there, Buddha is there with us in that. And but we can't reach it, but we can reassure ourselves that it is there. We can't reach it because of our misknowing right away, but it helps to feel connected by being aware that it is there and developing kind of faith about it, a sense of trust to the deepest level of energy of the universe, even an energy that is infinite, and then with the paradox that an infinite energy is quiescent and doesn't do anything because it doesn't need to do anything because everything is already done satisfactorily. Because it's infinite. So there's no need, in a way, from its own point of view, which is an infinite point of view. So even the word point of view doesn't fit. Point of view doesn't fit. So this is encouraging for us to begin the process of coming to know, of using our critical intellect, using our concentrated mind, tapping into that infinite energy that is generously open and available to us all to give us a rebirth in our enlightened being. So it's a useful way of orienting, tapping ourselves to be aware of its overriding presence, to be aware that it is the truth, it is the reality of things, the Buddha nature, the Buddha being, the Dharmakaya, the reality body, the super bliss body. It is comforting to know that, and it can be infinitely drawn to help us unravel and to help others unravel, help us unravel through cultivating our wisdom, and to help others unravel their misknowing through cultivating compassion, universal compassion for all beings. So imitating this sort of dualistic non-duality or non-dual dualism of wisdom and compassion, like two wings of a bird, which are non-dual in the sense they're both making the bird fly. But there are two of them, if you think of them as separate, you know, and yet they both connect to the body, and there you flap your shoulder blades. You know, when you're a bird, when we've all been birds, we flapped our shoulder blades and then wings stuck out from them instead of arms and hands, and we flew. And now we have to fly in it with our subtle bodies. We can do that. And we have to understand our union with all birds, actually, and how we are one with all of them in whatever time and space they exist. So anyway, that's what it's all about. So I want... Now, the way that this is presented in this era is that the part of the tireless Buddha, Nagarjuna, Sangha, you know, Chandrakirti, Shantideva, and Atisha, and Padmasambhava, and all the great Sakyapa Panditas, the great Nyingma masters, disciples, the 25 disciples of Padmasambhava, and the later great Nyingma masters, and the Milarepa, Naropa, Tilopa, Vajradhara, all of the great beings who saw to the wonderful thing they did to outsmart the violent people's attempt to destroy the limbically resonant, non-violent people in ancient classical Buddhist, Vedist India about 1,000 years ago, by moving the curriculum and moving the jewels of teaching and moving the wonderful, wonderful insights and the personal, person-to-person traditions from India up over the passes into Tibet, where they became embodied in new institutions, new curriculum, and brought the highly individualistic, very powerful-minded, strong individuals of the Tibetans and later the Mongolians into this quest of self-conquest, quest of uncovering, scientific uncovering of reality ahead of all the rest of people throughout the planet. And then, but preserving this treasure of the thousand-year classical time for us to be, which has become opened up to us today by His Holiness the 14th great Dalai Lama of Tibet, the first having been in that same Renaissance era of the 15th century, open to us now today, which we are slowly beginning to open, although it will take maybe three more generations before it's more fully open. But it's already vastly open, and there are vast numbers of beings who are ready for the limbic resonance today. You know, like in the Lotus Sutra, the Buddha predicts, he says, one guy listens to the Lotus Sutra, wherein the Buddha gives a demonstration and a teaching that of how he sees reality, and that all of reality, humans, plants, inanimate objects, animals, insects, hell beings, you know, demons, gods, angels, etc., all of reality is his own golden, blissful body of bliss. And he has that, gives that revelation to the beings in the Lotus Sutra. And then one young man, I forget his name, becomes very excited, who gets it, who sees it and gets it from hearing that teaching. Although, of course, they know that they haven't yet fully got it, but they begin to have a faith in it. They begin to have a confidence that they better start learning in order to discover it. And, you know, the conditional faith, not blind faith, conditional faith. And that young man says, oh, this is great. I'm going to give this Lotus Sutra teaching everywhere in the world. I'm going to take the burden. I'm going to do it. I'm going to take responsibility and I'm going to do it. And Buddha says, that's really great and that's really nice, but calm down. Don't worry. There's lots of bodhisattvas like you who are doing this. And then he says, look around you. And then he looks around and he sees these giant, like angelic, powerful bodhisattva beings. Bodhisattva means like a kind of being, but it could be ordinary being, but it's just a being who is moving himself and other and herself or herself and other beings in the right direction, and of which the female members of the human species are more advanced in those bodhisattva qualities than the male ones. I even were then and have always been, actually. They are the original example of the gentle and the more aware and the loving and the kind, being pushed around by the more violent and more stupid and the less aware ones, you know. Anyway, and he looks around and he sees this vast, like, blades of grass, as I said. He sees them growing, rising out of the earth like blades of grass everywhere, turning everyone onto this vision, you know, of the all rightness of reality, of the perfection, actually, of our of all reality, of real reality, not the unreal one. So no need, therefore, to feel trapped forever in this unreal reality of inadequacy and separation of self versus the universe. If you think you're separate from everything and you're the one, but you define that being the one as being separate from everything, then of course you lose, because everything, everyone and everything will eventually overwhelm you if it's you versus them, because you're absolutely different from them and it. So that's a simple teaching of what's called the truth of suffering, the fact, the noble fact for a noble person of suffering. So that's what you need to overcome, that one. But you can't do just by saying, okay, I'll just won't think that. It's not that easy. You have to slowly critique it. You have to look for that sense of self that's being separate, and you have to fail to find it definitively, and then really come to cope with the failure to really find anything that's really separate. And then when you do that, you begin to become transparent to your own insight, to your own knowing. And by knowing through your transparent self, you begin to discover the transparency of the universe. And when you discover that, you begin to feel released and happy, and you overcome the sense of opposition between you and others, you and the whole universe, you and time, you and space. And you begin to start the process of evolutionarily expanding your sense of self-identification. You identify yourself as everyone. You identify yourself as everything. You identify yourself as every being, including all other non-human animals, the lower ones and the higher ones, the gods and demons and titans, etc., all of them. So anyway, this is the gist of what I'm saying. And then I want to read a little bit from my preface of this great book, which you can find through the Columbia University Press, if you get interested about it, which goes through tremendous, excruciating, and blissful and wonderful details with parables and similes and metaphors and analyses. It's just magnificent. You know? So here I am writing. Usually the professor teaches the student, and the student learns from the professor. Maybe Bo, or as we all call him by nickname, Marty, I don't know why, Jiang, Bo Jiang is his Chinese name, but Jiang is the first, and Bo is a family name, I believe, learned a little from me, but I definitely learned a great deal from him. His doctoral dissertation project was to study Lama Tsongkhapa and sons, Gyaltsep being one of the foremost sons, interpretation of the Buddha nature issue, which, by the way, the word for nature, originally Sanskrit garbha, can also mean womb. And that's a wonderful thing. There's Nagarjuna, famous for, I'm not reading now, I'm explaining something. Nagarjuna has the wonderful phrase, as I think you know from previous podcasts, if you know my podcast, I have elaborated his wonderful expression for the highest teaching and the highest reality, which he calls emptiness, the womb of compassion. So the highest reality, meaning the deepest or the unexcelled, unsurpassed reality, meaning the one we're really in, is this kind of voidness, which is not an annihilative space of nothing or something. It is the relativity of all of the things and the spaces. So it's more subtle than just the spaces. You know, sometimes space is used as a metaphor or a simile for voidness, symbol for voidness, but you know, space is also occupied by things, you know, and it doesn't get in the way of the things in it. And so similarly, voidness simply guarantees the relativity of all the things in it. And really it is the teaching, the Buddha's teaching of emptiness or voidness is really the human in this cycle of literatures and histories and things in different languages on the planet, which is not the sole cycle, actually, but it is the fourth one, actually, the Buddhist historians say, fourth one on this particular planet. And this is the first scientific discovery of relativity, actually. Not only through mathematics, but although he was a master mathematician, but also through personal experience, beyond theories, actually being knowing by being, as I said, which is the ultimate kind of knowing, which is that ultimately inexpressible in words or concepts or numbers, which themselves are only derivative of that sort of inexpressible and innumerable and inconceivable reality of being. Okay? So emptiness is therefore signified by the word garbha, which means womb. And of course, womb gives, nurturing shelter to an embryo that's going to be born as a being, as a mammal being. Because for mammal, womb-born beings are mammals, right? We call them mammal. Very high form compared to egg-born and moisture-born types of beings. And in the sense that by being born within the body, by being shaped and formed within the body of another similar being, that being that's doing that is teaching us the lack of division and the lack of ultimate separation of self and other. So they are creating a body out of their body, which means ultimately there's no difference between our bodies. We are all one flow. There is a relative difference, but not ultimate difference. So emptiness or voidness is not a big blank space. It's a womb. And what does it produce in its womb? It produces compassion. And what is the ultimate product of compassion? Is the ability to go and relieve others of their suffering. So compassion has to embody itself in the form of any whatever entity it is that can approach a being that is suffering and alleviate that suffering. And in the form of imparting wisdom to that being, it being an intelligent being. And relatively, it could be medicine, it could be food, it could be whatever relative suffering they are suffering, that emptiness, that relativity can provide all of what every being needs. That's the key point. So our Buddha nature is the womb that is enfolding every cell of our being and every thought of our mind and every action of our body, speech or mind, is all enfolded within emptiness, which means it's fully relativistic, which means that it has a chance of becoming perfect in the sense of totally only manifested in perfect adaptation to the needs of that which it is contacting, that which it is permeating, that which it is enfolding within it. It's just a beautiful thing, really beautiful. So we all have Buddha womb. We all have a Buddha womb in which we ourselves as Buddhas are taking birth, and in which we can also give birth to all other beings by helping them through wisdom overcome their barrier of misknowing, self-identifying, separate self-identifying, fixated self-identifying suffering. Get them out of that envelope into the womb of what they really are. And we can be confident that that will work because we are only introducing them to what they really are. We're not asking them to believe some weird thing. It's not like a religion, believe some exotic or strange thing they never heard of. We're asking them to believe in themselves at the deepest level of the self, which is the relative, the infinitely relational self. It's not at the level of a self absolutely separated from everything. No. Many spiritual traditions have that kind of wrong view. Not only certain Buddhist ones do, and lots of non-Buddhist ones too. And that is, unfortunately, a dead end of self-isolation in states of total seeming obliteration. But there is no total obliteration because there is no nothingness space in which to go to there, because nothing is not there. So relational things always change into other relational things, even though can, with the power of the of the mind, of the human and divine and the demonic mind, the being can create a semblance of being separate from everything as an ultimate sort of security blanket, but it's only temporary. It's only a temporary construct. It's never permanent. It's not nirvana. It's not release. It's just a super hideout. And actually a super trap, therefore, since it's not the final destination. You can't stay dead, in other words. No one gets to stay dead. So you have to make life such that death is only a stepping stone within life, within the much larger life. Death is little moments of change within the larger life, the infinite life, the Amitayur. That's the only thing you can do. Okay, second paragraph. In the context of my own studies of Buddhist centrist philosophy, that's a scientific, and philosophy is science, by the way, and science is philosophy. The material sciences were once called natural philosophy, which is proper because they were using experience to examine things, and they were getting away from a kind of dead-end philosophy, a bunch of sort of metaphysical traps where you got stuck in dogma, and you rely more on experience, knowing by being, than theory, and non-dogmatic, you know, and against dogma. And so this philosophy means the ultimate science. Nowadays, philosophy has given up being science because it wrongly thinks. Its practitioners wrongly think, some of them. Unfortunately, the prevalent ones in our Western materialism-dominated culture, they think that materialistic science, or what some people call scientism or scientific materialism, is the final result of all human seeking, which is a mistake. It's a philosophical mistake. It's wrong. It's great, all the discoveries about the nature of physical objects, and it's so great that it has reached the point where it doesn't know, it goes beyond any kind of physical object that you can pin down, and therefore actually it's going beyond its own naive objectivism, and there is no objectivity. The mind is participant in creating objectivity, which doesn't mean it's all subjectivity either. It's an interactive, interpersonal, interrelational, interrelativistic universe. And mind is just subtle part of, is subtlest energy, and matter is crystallized energy into seemingly static forms, temporarily static forms. So the centrist philosophy, Madhyamaka philosophy, is that which comes from the experience of being in the center, that everywhere is the center of the universe. Everywhere is the clear light, infinite energy of clear light of the void. That is everywhere. That is what constitutes everything. And so I had learned, but I had learned to view the Buddha nature as a doctrine promulgated by the Buddha to comfort those who are addicted to soul theories, meaning those who are so sensitive and spiritual and afraid of suffering that they imagine that there's a state beyond suffering that they can reach where they will be isolated from any hurt, from any pain, from anyone else bothering them. They give up connection to anyone else being nice to them, but they feel that ultimately beings will not be nice. They're afraid and they're sensitive. And so they think that they have a theory that my soul, my real self, is some fixed absolute thing that I can withdraw away into and I can be absolutely apart from any kind of interaction which might bring me any suffering. So that's the wrong kind of soul theory. Buddhist soul theory, on the other hand, is a theory that your soul is a super subtle evolving agency, totally relativistic, nothing absolute about it except its continuum in time. In that sense, you can say absolute in that it's internal, and its ability to embrace infinity itself and find its identity with infinity itself, which is kind of its absolute relativity. That's what that is. So in that sense, but those are not theories, those are experiences. And theories that open you to those experiences only. And so, as a skillful teacher or therapist, I thought the Buddha understood that such persons needed help to approach the voidness or emptiness that he discovered to be the ultimate, absolute, or supreme reality of all things. recognizing that people often misunderstand and fear such an ultimate, that is, ultimate relativity, due to their tendency to confuse voidness with nothingness and the fixated idea that, quote, realization of the ultimate, unquote, is just a spiritualist euphemism for self-annihilation. And here I fear there are many Buddhists with this misunderstanding, as well as members of other philosophical and religious traditions. This teaching, because not all Buddhists are Buddha scientists, unfortunately, and yet, let's say. This teaching of, quote, Buddha nature, unquote, was thus offered, I had been thinking, along with the idealistic, that is to say, Vijnanavada, the mind-only school, or Chittamatra school of thought, which from the centrist viewpoint is also a kind of reassuring, interpretable, and not definitive teaching that helps aspiring bodhisattvas scientifically and contemplatively dissolve the apparent solidity of the physical world while feeling confident in the reality of it in its more subtle mental nature. So in other words, the mind-only school, I think, is real purpose, sort of letting people be idealists, thinking that my mind creates reality, and going a little bit into the extreme of that thought. They, you know, beings who ignorantly identify their mind as sort of their absolute self, at least on some subtle level. And because when you think the world and its reality are just mind, you can be encouraged as a bodhisattva from your compassion, your love and universal love and compassion for sensitive beings, you can be encouraged to think, I can change all of this. I can save them all. Because in a way, my mind is holding them in their suffering. And if I can shift around my mind, I shift around the universe, including them as suffering beings, and make them liberated, happy beings. So you have the courage when you think of something as mental, because we know mental is sort of more subtle and insubstantial. If you're looking out at the world and you see it all as stars and rocks and flames and volcanoes and oceans and mountains, you might feel, I can transform all of this? What? With my mind? No way. You know, you might feel discouraged about becoming a bodhisattva and making the vow, taking the oath to become a Buddha throughout all your infinite future lives. So the mind only really is the base of what the Tibetans call the magnificent deed lineage of the universal vehicle taught by Buddha. The activist, that is the activist, world-transforming lineage. Okay, whereas the centrist school, really going deep into emptiness relativity, is said to be those who are focusing on that are said to be the profound reality lineage, tradition of the universal vehicle. I had also noted that the centrist's own view is that the Buddha nature is really just emptiness itself, in that on the ultimate level, beings are primordially indivisible from the Buddhas in their reality body. So in a sort of primal level, beginningless, but not from the beginning, like some theistic idea, monotheistic idea, but from beginninglessness of the universe, they're primarily indivisible from the Buddhas in their reality body. So, you know, emptiness, since we're just as empty as any Buddha, then because of that reality, we are one with the reality body of the Buddha, because we are reality. Even though we don't know it as fully, and the only difference is the Buddha fully knows it, and we don't know it. So we don't enjoy it as much as the Buddha does. Since that reality is super bliss, release and freedom, and everything is happy and done and blissful and no suffering. And by the way, not an annihilated no suffering of annihilation, because there's no such thing. And no suffering of joy, bliss. So, and I had pretty much left it at that, not going into it further or more deeply. And in that way, when you think of it as just emptiness, I guess I had been thinking somewhere subtly still that enlightenment is a state of sort of kind of maybe a luminous nothingness, but a kind of nothingness. someone in the 60s once jokingly said, like, the whole universe is a giant jar of warm Vaseline or something. So nobody has to slither around in it. It's just all like that. But that's still subtly keeping alive the idea of being isolated from differentiation, rather than, and therefore it cuts off your compassion for those who don't feel that. In other words, you have to feel that and feel that you haven't destroyed the reality of wherever people are differentiated. The unknowing people, the misknowing people, are differentiated. They're different. And they keep up the difference. And you who know it's not different are different in that you must manifest whatever it takes to help them find the undifferentiated side without destroying their joy of differentiation. There's a wonderful verse by Buddha, by Maitreya, actually, in another of his works that he channeled through a Sangha, the ornament of the universal vehicle literature. And that says, we never say there's only one Buddha, and we never say there are many Buddhas. We don't say there are many Buddhas because all Buddhas are one in their ultimate reality embodiment, their reality body, ultimate level of truth or reality. But we don't say there's only one Buddha because all Buddhas individually get to enjoy their being one with all the other Buddhas and other beings who are not Buddhas yet, but who will be. And once you become a Buddha, you're present in every moment of time. You enjoy the other beings' future Buddha. There's time is what separates them. They feel they need time to develop to become that. You see their future time where they do finally become it as real as the present time where they don't know they are it, type of thing. So therefore, we never say it's only one Buddha. We never say there are many Buddhas. There's one Buddha in one sense and many Buddhas in another sense. And we are individually going to enjoy being Buddhas, and partly because we'll enjoy being one with all Buddhas, same as all of them. Really fun, really great. So working with Marty, now this is how I was thinking, okay? Working with Marty, however, that is Bojang, on the sublime continuum of Maitreya Anatta, its commentary by Arya Sangha, and its super commentary by Tsongkhapa's heart son, Gyaltsep Rinpoche, I gained a whole new perspective, even a touch of insight into the much more beautiful reality expressed in these works. Again, I had heard that the Tibetans in general consider Maitreya's Sublime Continuum to be a centrist work, not an idealist one. In other words, not mind only, but actually the relativistic level of mind and matter, mind and energy, and ultimately no difference on the super subtle level, and therefore theoretical, hypothetical ability to be either materialistic or spiritualistic, not making those rigid dogma in either direction, which is really the Buddhist worldview, is that there is no formula that captures the inconceivability, miraculous nature of the real world, but it can be known by being. It can be known beyond being and non-being by being, put it that way. Maitreya's Sublime Continuum to be Maitreya's centrist work, not an idealistic one, as the great Indian and Tibetan philosopher practitioners, scientist adepts, were often not locked up within a particular rigid ideology, but were true dialecticists or dialogical pedagogues who attuned their theories to the level of resilience or neural receptivity or limbic resonance of their students or fellow seekers. I knew this was somewhat controversial in Tibet even, in that there were some Tibetan philosopher yogis who considered the idealistic school the highest school and had come up with what they presented as an innovative synthesis of idealism with centrist relativism. This was called the Great Centrism by them, and it was connected with a teaching called Other Emptiness, which stepped back or stepped beyond as they would claim, the rigorously logical non-dualism of mainstream Indian and Tibetan centrism, wherein ultimate emptiness is understood as empty of itself, and hence something like the mere negation, which is nothing other than the inconceivable relativity of the world, and not an absolute nothingness like a blank space, within which relative things appear with an illusory quality. I know that's a mouthful, and I think maybe in a later podcast I will come back to that paragraph and do a whole thing just commenting on that sentence, which I don't, somebody else wrote it, I swear. So anyway, to continue though, if the absolute emptiness is misconstrued as an other or alternative reality separate from the relative, a space empty of the relative, which is other than it, the realization of that other becomes a destruction of the relative, an ultimate isolation of the realizer from the relative world of other beings. And it is like the similar dualistic relative versus absolute view of the individual vehicle Buddhist philosophers, such as the Theravadins, etc. That is to say, somehow jumping away logically from the conceptual duality of absolute being non-relative, relative being non-absolute, and jumping into some idea that there's a kind of absolute that can act relatively. There's a kind of absolute that can have a relative boundary between itself and the relative. Obviously, an absolute cannot have a boundary, cannot relate, or it becomes relative. So you when you do that, you're departing, you're crippling your critical mind, your logical mind, which is one of the great achievements of your humanity, which should not be crippled. You shouldn't think, of course, that your conceptual mind can hold on to ultimate reality forever in complete way. That is a delusive dead end also. But while you have your critical mind, you have to honor it. And even you achieve the non-dual ultimate experience of reality, which and go beyond words and concepts in your experience, that in that going beyond, you discover the incredible relative value of valid concepts and valid critical reasonings and valid insights, which is our special human gift. And they themselves are all made of the non-dual, infinite, clear light of the void energy, and therefore they should function efficiently and beautifully and effectively, and they shouldn't just be the one thing that's trashed through some destructive, you know, since you're, by defining your ultimate experience as something that destroys forever any connection with all relativity, even though you came from being connected. And so therefore, your experience is relative of that kind of an absolute. Okay? So however, if the absolute emptiness is misconceived as other alternative reality separate from the relative, a space empty of the relative which is other than it, the realization of that other becomes a destruction, at least in your personal experience, of the relative, an ultimate isolation of the realizer from the relative world of other beings, and it is like a dualistic, relative versus absolute, samsara versus nirvana view of the individual vehicle Buddhist philosophers, not to mention many, many spiritual beings in other traditions who consider that they annihilate themselves in God or they do this and that, and then they're forever apart from the world. And they become God, conceived as some being that's outside of the world. And that is just that dead end of self-annihilation, actually. It's a kind of super psychosis, psychotic state of hiding from relationality instead of embracing lovingly infinite relationality, which is what the Buddha state is. And some monotheistic mystics, I'm sure, dealt with that, even though it's not philosophically skillfully addressed in most of the great philosophers of the monotheism because of their canning of the absolute relative logic at some stage of blind faith. But people in their experience will still find, because once they become feeling that they are one with God, then they will somehow subliminally be remembering that God is engaged in the beings of the world and loves them. And so they become engaged with that love, and they cannot leave the beings in the world because they realize God doesn't leave them. And they maybe don't bother critically to notice that that means that God is relational, not absolute, any particular form of God that they approached the clear light of the void with, the infinite impersonal love or transpersonal love of the clear light of the void, of infinite energy being available to fulfill any need, which is what love will do, right? So, but the Tibetan other emptiness, for now I'm going back to reading, but the Tibetan other emptiness philosophers are not formal individual vehicle dualists. They are universal vehicle bodhisattva way practitioners. So they added to their view of a substantial absolute that it possesses excellent qualities, which is the kind of theological assertion that asserts the relativity of the absolute out of enthusiasm and faith, making a kind of hyperbolic fact out of a divine absolute, as in the various theisms of the world, or in the absolute other power, Zettai Tariki in Japanese, forms of East Asian Buddhisms, such as the Pure Land schools, which doubtless started with the now unknown Indian Amitabha and Sukhavati paradise cults, religiously beautiful movements. They therefore presented a path to sudden enlightenment, evolutionarily super swift pathways, since just by, quote, realizing emptiness, unquote, conceived as being losing oneself in an infinite space-like experience, all the relative qualities of Buddhahood would automatically adhere to one, and the relative Buddha bodies of beatitude and emanation, you know, the Sambhogakaya, as it's called, and the Nirmanakaya, would emerge from the pregnant absolute and become impatient bodhisattva and become one's relative Buddha vehicle. This assertion becomes highly attractive to impatient bodhisattvas, since it seems to obviate the need for the inconceivably arduous evolutionary path of relative self-transcendences through in many lifetimes through generosity, ethical actions, and patient forbearances, which mainstream universal vehicle Buddhism insists is the essential causality making possible the inconceivable relative excellences of Buddhahood. This was claimed, this attribution of excellent relative qualities to the Supreme Absolute then was claimed by these other emptiness philosophers as the real secret offering of the Buddhist tantras, enabling the acceleration of the evolutionary causality of billions of lives into a single life, etc. So for them, the tantric secret becomes a different reality teaching that the Buddha is supposed to have withheld from his non-esoteric disciples, which makes the Buddha into the kind of teacher who held the highest teaching hidden behind his back in what he himself disparaged as the closed fist of a bad teacher. Finding this not in character for a perfect Buddha, because they wouldn't withhold anything from anybody who needed it, we return to rigorous reasoning in the ordinary causation plane of relative reality, and rather consider the tantric super swift way to be high tech compression of the billion lifetimes path into one or three or seven or 16 lifetimes of relative self transcendences, highly dangerous but possible for a select group of bodhisattva disciples, taught freely to all, but usable only by those at a certain level of ability. That's just so far out. I really amazed that it came out of my typing fingers, if not my understanding. I don't claim to really understand it fully. But in a way, when I read it, I do. But I don't pretend ultimately to. I think it helps me, though. And it will help you if you think about it. In the approach of the present works of Maitreyanatha, Asanga, and Gelsop, the sublime continuum is persuasively revealed to be a dialogical centrist text, that is to say, a relativist, super subtle, open to all theories and realities type of text. Not an idealist one, insisting on mind only. Addressing the deep issue of the seemingly contradictory relationship between the Buddha's experience of beings as blissfully, indivisibly, inseparable from themselves in their experience of in their inconceivable truth body, inseparable from themselves, that is, from the Buddha selves, in their inconceivable truth body, ultimate level, and the suffering beings' experience of themselves as suffering and alienated and separated not only from Buddhas, but from all other beings and things. So that seems to be contradicted, and that's a deep issue, which the centrist philosophy addresses in what Marty Jiang called cataphatic emptiness, meaning positive thinking emptiness, positively thought emptiness. Relativity, that is. This issue is addressed therein without using the cloak of inconceivability to hide the incoherence of the assertion that an uncaused, uncreated, quiescent absolute can itself cause relative phenomena such as Buddha excellences. Instead, it takes radical non-duality taught by such teaching as the voidness of voidness, emptiness of emptiness, to affirm that the evolutionary causality of the billion lifetimes of self-transcending evolution can be compressed on a subtle, dreamlike causal plane of the tantric mandala into a relatively short period due to the power of universal compassion drawing on the immense demand of beings suffering to fuel a subnuclear fusion energy of immense power to miniaturize vast lengths of time into microseconds. So the inconceivable artfulness, skill, what people call skill in means, or technological skill, you could say, of Buddhas, is here seen not as involving a withholding of access to reality from disciples, but rather as giving each one artful access to aspects of reality that they are capable of using. And it brings the Buddha nature teaching and tantric revelation back into complete harmony with Nagarjuna's famous use of voidness, the womb of compassion, Shunyata Karuna Garbham, which itself is drawn from Shakyamuni's unexcelled yoga tantric revelations. Bracket, the phrase is especially prominent in the Kalachakra Tantra. Okay, so that's all for today. I might read a little more later about this particular thing, and I might go back over specific paragraphs in the future. But as to come back now to the general context of those of us struggling when we've reached a kind of nadir in a progression from Nixon to Reagan to Bush 1 to Bush 2 and to poor, dear, old Donald Trump, who didn't really want to have this job, really likes to live in luxury and have a lot of sensory fulfillment that he cannot feel deeper inside. And what he truly needs is a massage from inside out rather than more from outside in, which he unfortunately can only get using his intelligent mind to unravel his mistaken idea of his being in a fight with the universe, which is what causes him such endless frustration and endless suffering, and which is only magnified by being in this place where so many other beings are looking to him to uphold true relativity, responsible, friendly, kind, generous, altruistic, heroic even, relativity and relationality. You know, the wonderful vision of Jefferson, of the U.S. bringing to life truly enlightened governance to support evolution of beings through education toward enlightenment, toward their own self-fulfillment, and the loving fulfillment of others. Not that it even in his time, Jefferson's time, or any time, this has ever been realized, but it has enabled many beings to move in that direction, which is why our culture still has some remaining vestige of soft power around the world, which we cannot allow to be destroyed any more than it has been in that negative progression that I just mentioned. But you, in your pursuing the positive, yes, yay saying, affirmative vision, you, in pursuing your wish for Donald Trump to have a situation in life that he will truly begin to enjoy instead of feeling it's the final extension of his battle to the death with the universe, now realizing it's a loving of the universe, with the universe, which is not that particular building, not that form of public housing, as my wife calls it, the White House. He is not ever going to be happy there. So you can be inexhaustible and tireless in your active, loving activism, humorous, joyful activism, where you can dance around with your $5, $10, $15 contributions to this and that honest leader opposing this and that, you know, con person, con man or con woman, in this and that segment of a restored vote, ungerrymandered district of our wonderful community. And you are inexhaustible by realizing that it's all good. And your greater strength over the seeming evildoers is your recognition that even they are just pathetically self-destroying and harming themselves and making themselves suffer, of course, as well as being really harmful to others, so intolerably so. But still, you will be sympathetic and compassionate to them. You will seek, the more they harm others, of course, the more miserable they become. The more it eats away at their, you know, circulatory system, at their heart tissue, at their heart fiber, you know, at the muscles of the valves of their heart, at their digestive tract, at their intestinal tract. The more awful food they pump down into it, the more terrible indigestion they have and ulcers, and the shorter their lifespan, and the more miserable every moment of it is. So relieving them from doing harm, relieving a harmful being from doing harm, is a compassionate thing to do. You can be fierce in that compassion as long as you're joyful and loving. Like a mother will be fierce in preventing her child from sticking its finger into an electric socket. She can be fierce in saying, "Don't do that." But she loves that child. She doesn't want it to hurt itself. So this is the kind of revolution we need. Social, political, consciousness revolution, sensitivity revolution. And we men can take the cue from our wives almost always, from our girlfriends, from our sisters, from our friends, female friends. They are ahead of us in this respect. So they're coming out with their pussy hats. It's something we have to learn from. We should proudly wear them. I don't have one, actually. I want one. And not shrink from that. Because that, and joyfully. And this will enable us to reassert, you know, even relational victory. And get back to creating supportive financial structures that will enable the great artists of our society to make better films, the highest art form of this time, better Netflix series like The Sense8 by the brilliant Wachowski sisters, which I suggest everyone to watch to observe limbic resonance in action and cultivate their own clairvoyance, telepathy, their own magic of sensitivity toward others, their own bliss, their bliss technology, their bliss skills. And then get back there as quickly as possible, because we need to flood the world under the oligarchs of the other societies with more limbic resonance laden soft power products, giving the beings alternative visions of their own oneness with the benevolence of reality. Remember that those who are so harmful and troublesome are ones who perceive reality itself as a dangerous and harmful place, that they have to be more dangerous than the dangers of the environment and more dangerous preemptively than others, and thereby make self-fulfilling prophecies of nightmare hellish conditions around themselves. That's their mistaken view. So the counter to that is realizing the benevolence of reality, the beauty of nature, of our true nature, which is bliss. Like the Medicine Buddha's vision of every plant in the universe is only there lovingly creating things that can support our biology. Doing their best to grow for us. Turn solar energy or solar rays into nice leafy vegetables and fruits. Okay. Lots of love. Big hugs to everybody. And have a great week until next week. And I'll come back in another podcast.